Season 3 of the Missing Witches podcast is lovingly sponsored by Foxglove Farm.
Welcome back to another episode of Witches Found, where we get to talk and meet and meld brains and fall in love with witches out there practicing in the world.
Now, Risa, you spoke to another one of our favorite witches. We've been really lucky this season, y'all. The amazing...
Amanda Yates Garcia.
A.K.A. Oracle of L.A.
Oh my God, is this witch. You must read her book, Initiated. You must picture her officiating to a crowd in L.A., banishing capitalism from our systems. And you must sit down and wrap yourself around something hot and delicious and listen to this powerful goddess preach on this interview. Welcome back to you at the Oracle of Los Angeles, and to our listeners who don't get to hear the missing interview that's out in the ether somewhere.
Do they know that we recorded an interview, I think it was last week,
yes.
And it went so well and it was so super exciting, but
yeah.
there were some technical snafus and so here we are again.
I think they do.
2.0 version.
They may know, because I posted about it so excitedly on Instagram that it happened, and also that, you know, an enormous storm came up while we were talking, and the sky was full of lightning behind me. It was crazy. We just had another enormous storm here last night. Water poured in both sides of this house that we're staying in.
Wow.
Filled the basement floor. We're really feeling like what it's like to be on the edge of a climate catastrophe these days. I'm sure you're feeling it.
The deluge has arrived.
Yeah, exactly. I said so many excited things, and I'll say them all again because I'm still so full of excitement to get to talk to you, and was just so honored and thrilled that you were able to make time for us and that you actually had heard of us, especially while you're in this like kind of crazy pre-book launch marketing hustle, marketing magic time.
Oh, wow, that is a real thing. It is intense.
Yeah.
Doing all that marketing stuff for the book is really a lot of labor.
Yeah.
And just kind of a constant stream of things. So I'm sure your listeners can identify, you know, with the idea of like going to your email inbox and everybody's got this like complicated question that requires you to like sign in to another like document, but then the password doesn't work and then you have to go back and get it, and then the question is really complicated, it's like four parts, and then you have to go in and look through your manuscript and pull out a quote, but that takes you like 45 minutes because mm-hmm. you're not sure where it is, and yada yada yada. Meanwhile, the emails are piling up and you're like having to get tickets and flights and all this stuff. So it's wild. It's like, you know, contemporary life.
Yeah,
capitalism,
right.
Is like chained to the,
yeah,
chained to your email.
And on top of this, like the work that you are putting out into the world is incredibly vulnerable.
Yeah.
So it's like,
you know, that's the thing.
Yeah.
Like it's so emotionally intense to put out a book like this. It's so different from, you know, other things that I put out like on social media that are, you know, more just prescriptive about like magic or how it works or spirituality or, you know, the astrology or you know, any of the other things that I talk about. Doing something that really bears your heart in a really personal and vulnerable way is, I mean, I think that's, I really feel like that's what's necessary, but that's the reason why I made the book was,
yeah,
because part of witchcraft for me is about intimacy, you know, and it is about vulnerability and about a willingness to experience the the most difficult and exquisite things in life. Yeah. And so I felt that, I also just felt like a lot of the books that are out there on witchcraft are kind of written from this perspective of, oh, I know this information and I'm going to impart it to you in this sort of how-to book style way, you know, and even books on spirituality often kind of come from a position of like, I've got this all sorted out now. But I feel like we're all sort of really in this together, kind of struggling through all of this stuff together. And I really wanted to share, like, on a really personal level, like, why this stuff matters so much to me. People often are asking me right now, like, why witchcraft? Why now? Mm. And I think it's because it really touches on something really true about our experience of the world, you know, our longing in this capitalist culture where we are chained to our emails. For, you know, to re-enchant the world, to have a more meaningful and purposeful life, and to see nature as sacred. And we're all really hungering for justice. We're hungering for new kinds of spiritual connection that haven't been written yet. And you know, the icon of the witch is something that is so powerful and holds so much resonance for so many people, but specifically women and female identifying people. And so I really wanted to show why, like, why that matters so much, like, what, like, why it means so much to me to have this and to be able to work in this way with witchcraft and the ideas that I wrestle with about it as well. Because I think another thing that's problematic in almost all spiritual traditions, or at least a lot of the time when we read about them, is that we're just supposed to sort of accept that, you know, the premise of the religion or the spiritual practice is true, or accept that, you know, the authorities that give us that information are speaking correctly. And yet we don't really, I mean, I think most of us question, or maybe we harbor like secret doubts, or we feel some anxiety about it. And specifically with people who are interested in witchcraft or any kind of, you know, contemporary forms of spirituality, we might call New Age spirituality. You know, if you are a person of intelligence, or you have a academic background, you know, you can't be unaware of the criticisms that are directed towards such spiritualities. And so I think we can and should question and interrogate and explore and be and recognize that it's okay to have doubts. And so, you know, in my book, I talk about how I really wrestle with it. I really wrestle with the, you know, the legacy of witchcraft throughout my life, specifically because I was brought up with it, you know, and I think a lot of people who are brought up in the craft, you know, have similar concerns and challenges because, you know, when people find out that I was brought up by a witch, they often have this sort of romantic or idealized view, as if, you know, my entire childhood was spent, you know, dealing tarot cards and burning incense and chanting hymns to the goddess and, you know, beneath the moonlight. And there was a lot of that, but there were all, like, I also got grounded and rebelled, and my mother was not perfect and was dealing with her own, you know, very challenging upbringing. And didn't know, you know, like, also had to deal with the fact that she lives in a capitalist patriarchal culture where she was subject to a lot of abuse, and it was very difficult for her financially when I was a child. And so it's not like I just stepped outside of that, right, you know, because I was brought up in witchcraft, and that just didn't happen. And for me, that's really important to acknowledge, because I think it's very easy for people to look at their lives and think, oh, but I don't live the spiritual life. Like, we see, like, this idea of spirituality on Instagram where there's somebody, like, in, like, an immaculate white outfit sitting on a mountaintop, you know, with their hands in some like Zen mudra. And we're like, oh, but that's not the life that I'm living. Yeah. Can I? And we kind of want to be that person maybe, or some people do, but like I think real spirituality and real witchcraft happens in the messiest places. And that's why we need it and use it.
Yeah. And, I think also so often from myself and listeners of our podcast that I've gotten in touch with it, we're drawn to witchcraft because of our trauma. So to see a version of the world represented in this spiritual discourse that doesn't have a space for the violence and mess and trauma that we've experienced just doesn't resonate with the kind of healing that we need, that we're going looking for, you know?
That is so true. I mean, I genuinely believe that this legacy of trauma is in fact what is inspiring so many people to be turning towards witchcraft right now. Because in fact, the legacy of trauma, the story, the lineage of trauma is built in to the history of witchcraft, you know. So it's a practice of the exiles and the forgotten and the abused and the marginalized, and has been certainly throughout, you know, its most recent several thousand years of history. And even though some of that is definitely mythologized, you know, like I hear a lot of critiques. You know, for instance, recently there's kind of a famous, ceremonial magician who was saying, you know, oh, you know, only 40 to 50,000 witches were burned during the Inquisition or were killed. And in fact, you know, I've heard ranges from 40,000 to 100,000, sometimes more.
Yeah.
When I was growing up, of course, I was like watching the movie, The Burning Times.
Yeah.
And, you know, my mother was very, very much believed the information that was being put out at the time, specifically in those spiritual communities that like up to 9 million women were burned or killed. And, you know, I see that now as a mythology. You know, there is sort of the mythology of woman as martyr within the traditions of witchcraft, and I talk about that a little bit in my book. But also, like, women, even if they weren't being burned at the stake, like, there is such a history of trauma and abuse within, like, the lineage of women and female identifying people on this planet. Like, that's like, I look back to my mother and then her mother and then her mother and her mother and her mother and her mother. And I can go back, you know, countless generations and see like the sort of endless assaults and challenges that women have faced. And so even if they weren't being necessarily burned as witches, I think that the reality of, you know, abuse was very present for women of the medieval period.
And then I think there's also the broader context that so often that number can be treated dismissively by people who say, you know, it was exaggerated, or those stories, they weren't really, there wasn't a unified, you know, goddess worshiping culture or something that sort of all gets taken on. But one thing I found interesting during the podcast is that wasn't the only place where a colonizing force called people witches and used it as an excuse to murder people.
Exactly. And this is still happening today, like all over the world, you know, specifically, Sylvia Federici talks about it in her most recent book, specifically in African countries and, in the Indian subcontinent, you know, and for a lot of the same reasons that the witches were persecuted in medieval Europe. And then, you know, once that was accomplished, as she describes, Sylvia Federici describes in Caliban and the Witch, then, you know, once the the sort of total submission was accomplished in Europe, then the age of quote-unquote exploration began, where the colonizing forces went out and enforced this brutal regime of exploitation and enslavement and, like, genocidal murder, basically, yeah. Around the rest of the world. And obviously to an even greater degree because of the implicit racism and white supremacy involved in the people who are participating in that project. So, I mean, all of this is very, like, heavy stuff. And yet I see witchcraft. I was speaking about all this with my mother because we were, I have to talk with her a lot now about all of this because, like, her, you know, there's a lot that's very vulnerable revealed about her in the book as well. But she was saying that ultimately the book is about, like, redemption and triumph and ecstasy in a way. Like, it's about, I feel like people turn to witchcraft, people turn to magic, people turn to their spiritual practices that connect them to the earth because it empowers us, because it emboldens us, because we then are able to create a relationship with the planet, with the people around us, with the other beings that we share this world with. And that relationship is love, and that is what saves us. You know, that's what empowers us and strengthens us in our own lives on a really personal and micro level, just, you know, in the simplest things, like getting over a breakup, for instance, or trying to find a source of income that can support you without destroying your soul, you know, on those really small levels. But then on larger universal levels as well, about, you know, about working together, you know, with our planet, within the ecosystems, and then with, sharing the planet with other beings and other people. I believe that witchcraft can support us in that as well, or the way, you know, sort of the practices of the earth-based religions or spiritualities is a testimony to that.
I was listening to your podcast today.
Oh, you were.
Yeah, it's so good. It's because I was in there looking and I hadn't listened to the temperance episode, and that card kept coming up for me a couple months ago when I was asking about, like, kind of surviving this period of being back to work after my maternity leave. And then I was listening to things and trying to not be nervous for our conversation again today, and saw that you guys are very professional witches. You call yourselves professional witches. You are professional witches. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's that
if you declare witchcraft on your tax returns, then I guess you earn the right to call yourself a professional.
Like, there, you get technical and deep right off the bat. Your podcast is so amazing because I think people can go there and feel, like, very healed and very held and also, like, very schooled.
Probably that's true. I know. I mean, part of the challenge is that, you know, because Sarah and I practice so much and have both been doing it for so long, it's easy for us to forget what we don't know. So sometimes, right, like, for instance, I was just thinking for this next episode that's coming out tomorrow, like, we talk about the cards of the year, and I just remember that we don't really go into how we get that, you know, number or what the cards of the year are, and we just kind of, like, assume a base level of knowledge. So I think that that's probably something we could work on. But on the other hand, like, I feel like, you know, especially, like, for instance, like, with witch books or whatever, like, there's so many great beginning, like, basic level witch books that are saying things like, this is how you choose a crystal, or, you know, this is what llamas is. And so I feel like there's room for all, you know,
yeah,
some advanced topics in there as well.
Yeah, of course. And I mean, I like that you are very much, it seems to me from reading your incredibly beautiful book, Initiated, which is coming out soon, that you're very much like kind of in both camps, in the sense that like you can get real technical and deep into some schools of thought, but you also really like empower the idea that like you can just make up your own ritual, and that'll probably work too. Like you can stand in a stream and speak to the stones, and that's like totally allowed, and it'll work.
Yeah, well, that's so important, because witchcraft is really about intimacy with life, and it's definitely not about accepting someone else's authority structure for you, and just sort of adopting that blindly. Having said that, though, I feel like it is important. Like, lineage is important, and like we don't just just erase all of the knowledge base that's been built up through, you know, generations of people doing this work. But on the other hand, I think it is important to have that direct mystical relationship with the divine, with spirit, with the spirits of the earth. Without that, you can't really practice witchcraft. I mean, well, you can try it, but you won't really be getting out of it you won't be doing it in the spirit of what it is.
Right. Yeah, I think that's an interesting and important point, the respect for lineage, especially when so much of it has been so violently erased so many times, and by colonizing forces in so many cultures over and over and over again.
Well, yeah, exactly. Like, there's been so much erasure, and also there's a lot of problematic work that happens when just anybody kind of can just waltz in and say, oh, I'm a witch and I'm going to teach classes on witchcraft, and you know, start sort of spouting off whatever comes into their head, or, you know, maybe they read a few books on witchcraft and then put forward all what they know about it. But the problem with that, of course, is that it's really easy to spread misinformation. Yeah. And I think, like you said, though, the real main problem with it is that erasure of like depths of knowledge and experience, or it feels a little bit like belittling almost to say that anybody could just sort of walk in and start doing it with the same depth as people who might have been doing it for like 20 years or even 50 years. And I think paying attention to our elders and listening to them and cherishing the knowledge that they earned over decades of experience is also really important.
I love in your book that you sort of tell these stories that move the reader along with you through what you describe as an underworld. I mean, and it's very much a real world that you live and that we all live and get lost in. But then you also describe a journey through like a fairy world or a summer land that can feel like you've made it. You're out. Everything is enchanted now. You've found this like spectacular vibration. There might be a lot of drugs there. It's okay. We're free now, you know. And then like that's not quite it either, you know. And that's part of the journey. But like I think that can be a really terrifying part of the, and maybe that's sort of, you describe, you know, Persephone always in the underworld realizing she's still there. You know, that like, I guess that's sort of a question I always still have, is like, how do we keep finding that reenchanted this world, you know, this place, that not lost place? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, so if I'm understanding your question, you're saying that the things that so often seem to present us with solutions to help us escape this underworld, which is essentially the world where we are, where we don't have agency, right? Where we're sort of at the mercy of the forces around us, and they do not have our best interests at heart. That so often the things that we think might present us with this this freedom, this key to our freedom, often just invite us into or lure us into like a new version of subjugation. Is that, am I understanding you correctly? And that then you're asking, you know, how do we get out of that bind?
Yes. Oh, hell yes. And I'm like taking advantage of an interview to ask you for therapy now.
Yeah. Well, so first of all, one of the things that I love about witchcraft is that it invites us to participate in our life, in rather than just to see it as something that is happening to us, but we're sort of invited into the game, you know, into the story where we are heroines of this story. And so the object of the game is not to end it as swiftly as possible, but to fully participate in it with a sense of power and agency. And in fact, that understanding is what ultimately leads us out of the underworld, if it can be said that we can, in fact, do that. So what that means is that we, and the conclusion one of the conclusions I come to in the book, which I hope is not like spoiler alert, is that we don't look to find our way out, but we look to the ground right beneath us. In other words, we look to our life right here, right now, as it is, and decide to transform it where we are. And to do that requires you to acknowledge your own power and resources and skills. And the book is called Initiated because our lives are initiating us to give up, you know, each initiation that we go through or that we undergo, often unwillingly, often without even realizing that we're doing it, gives us a gift that we can then use to transform that ground, to transform that world around us, so that we're not necessarily looking to escape, which is what I was always doing as a young person. Like, I just wanted to get out of this or get out of that, you know, like I wanted to get out of the jobs that I was working in, you know, I wanted to get out of a feeling of not being on the right path all the time. I wanted to get out of, you know, like what I thought were like relationship, like wrong dimensions, you know, like where I was like, this is not the right way. This is not the way this relationship should be happening. There's some other ideal dimension for this relationship. And I somehow must've fallen into the wrong dimension, sort of the upside down.
Completely.
And, you know, where I really found my power, where I really feel like I truly became a witch was when I started to realize that there was no escape and that I was going to transform my life based on what was here. And to do that requires that you really see the gifts that you have that only you have, that you have earned. And they're like kind of the only keys that can open up the doors for you, and then to join forces with other people who have been through those initiations as well, and that this is the way that we will ultimately re-enchant the world by doing that. But I wonder if that answers your question, or how you interpret that, then, like what that would look like for you or for a hypothetical someone.
I don't know what it would look like for a hypothetical someone, but it does answer my question. I love that you come back to that phrase from Sylvia Federici of Reenchant the World. That phrase has been like very talismanic for me in the past little while too. And when I read a friend that quote, and I'll read it now, from your book about map makers, I reached that line at the end, and it was like, everybody stop and talk to me about Reenchant the World. Like, pull up the text, tell me what you're talking about. I need to know everything about this immediately, for someone who is like, you know, a film producer and was like, wait a second. Yes, something about that is so deeply right. And maybe before we keep going, if it's all right with you, do you mind if I read that?
Yeah, that please. Quote?
In our travels through the underworld, witches become mapmakers. Culture, art, the mystery religions, these systems of symbols are maps. Somebody has to create them. Our musicians and healers, poets and witches, travel through the corridors of the underworld by torchlight. We were not wrong to descend into these caves, but for our own sakes, for the peace of mind of those we love, and for the sake of the planet, we who travel there need to not get lost. We can join our lights together and return to the world. We can use our symbols, our stories, our mystical methodologies to forge connections with each other in these underground spaces. Symbols and stories order our world. They create the narratives by which we live. It matters whose stories get told. It matters how we tell them. Imagination matters. Our connections to one another matter, as does the pleasure we take in our experience. Witches stand in solidarity with those already doing this work, because people have been doing this work since humans first appeared on the surface of the earth. Now we listen to them. We participate. We use techniques of the healer, the poet, the artist, the scholar, the cunning folk to reenchant the world.
Yes.
Yes.
I wrote that.
You wrote that. Do you feel like you wrote that? Do you feel like something came through you? It's so good, man.
I mean, the cost of writing that, just, you know, like I really paid for it in blood. It was such a painful process. I had to go through so many layers of my own self-doubt and anxiety and insecurity and writer's block, so that I kind of approached my writer's desk every day, like on my bloody knees, kind of wading through the snow up a forlorn, inhospitable mountain to get to that place where I would just like sit there for hours and hours and nothing would come, or things would come and I would doubt it. And then, you know, every word in that book was like wrested from the hands of a vengeful angel that I kind of pulled. And that was, so I feel like, you know, a lot of it, then I would have moments like of sort of transcendence or lucidity, especially, you know, I was doing a lot of work with different deities and spirits at the time, Hecate, Hermes, Persephone, the Muses, and I was calling them in, and, you know, they would come. They would kind of come in like a rush and a holler into the room and like just kind of lighted it up with the power of their voices. But, you know, there's a reason why like medieval mystics would like beat themselves with like leather straps and wear hair shirts and stuff to get to that moment of mystical transcendence. There's something, at least for me, I would love to be able to just kind of step into the room and be like, here it is. I'm like right in that place. But I'm not always able to do that. Most of the time I'm kind of wrestling to get there.
I relate to that feeling of wrestling to get there. I do that with every storytelling episode of the podcast. It's so frustrating.
Painful. Because the thing is, like, we always do get there if we sit there long enough and we do it, that we would think that we could just trust it, you know? Like, of course, for me, you know, the first drafts, is like a total horrendous nightmare of embarrassment. Or like if you read it, you'd be like, oh my God, like, like this is like some, like, just, you know, whatever shitty first drafts we've all heard about that. And then, you know, in the second draft, it kind of starts to take on a more like human form. And then by the third draft, I start to go, oh, this is pretty good. And I'm proud of this, you know, that I feel confident with this. And then sometimes when I go back and read some of it, I'm like, wow, that is really good. Did I write that? And then, you know, of course, there's always things that I feel like I wish I would have changed or done more. And usually that stuff has to do with either lovers or parents or people that I love who I'm talking about. You know, when you're writing about another person, I just want to do them justice, you know, like I want to always approach them with like reverence and awe and beauty and humility and also like honesty for my own experience. And, you know, there's certain moments where I was like, oh, did I really do that person justice? Like, was I generous enough? Like, was I accurate enough? And I always want to be, but there's almost like, I just feel like I could just go back and write more and more and more about different people that I've encountered, because, you know, each person is a world unto themselves, as Rilke says.
And there's infinite versions of our stories, you know. So at a certain point, you do have to have faith that the thing that emerged, or the line that you found through, or like the path that you found through that particular part of the underworld was okay. It was enough, you know.
Well, yeah. Well, just for example, recently I was speaking with my mother about the section in the book where I was talking about how as a child I used to have horrible nightmares. A lot of witches have this experience. Yeah. You know, I had horrible nightmares and I would go get my mother and I would sleep with her, or I would have her come and sleep with me, which it's also, I think, very common for a lot of children.
Yeah.
But then when my mother married my stepfather, he wouldn't allow me into the room. But I would still have these horrible nightmares. But he didn't want me in his room or touching his bed or any of that. And so my mother would wake up and find me, like, sleeping on the floor outside of their bedroom door. And she would just have to kind of step over me as I was like sleeping there curled up in my blanket, and she would feel so horrible. And it really felt like a true exile for me, because I had this love that I was getting and then I wasn't getting it anymore. And then my brother was allowed, when he was born, to sleep in their room and touch their bed and do all of that stuff, which hurt, obviously. But recently I was speaking with my mother, because of course for her reading the book, there's a lot of moments where she feels like, she said, like, she wants to defend herself, or like she wants to explain or something.
Right.
And she said that, you know, because she had suffered such extraordinary abuse at the hands of her father, that, you know, my stepfather knew that, and so he was terrified of being accused of the same thing. And also she was doing a lot of work for, you know, this thing, this project called SAVE, which was like an anti-child abuse project. And he just didn't want to have anything to do with that. And so he erred on the side of extreme caution by basically being like, she can't come in her room, she can't touch her bed, like, I will not get anywhere near this child. And so even though, of course, as a child, that wouldn't have mattered to me, I wouldn't have known that or understood that, like, I it still hurt me that I was, you know, sleeping on the floor as an exile like that. But if I had known that while I was writing it, I feel like maybe I might have approached that differently, or at least said something about that. But I didn't know that then. You know, she read the book and then she was like, she was telling me about that moment. And so exactly as you're saying, you know, trying to approach the truth, like, I wrote the truth as I understood it in that moment, but I also wrote, and one of the reasons why it was painful and why I always approached on my knees was because I also knew that, like, the truth that I feel about a moment in my life, or about witchcraft, or about what the underworld is, or about any relationship that I've had, is like that truth from that moment. But like all of us can look back at relationships that we might have had, or opinions that we would have had, or spiritual practices that we might have had, and have a very different relationship to them now than we did when we were in them. And then even 10 years from now, we'll have a different relationship, or we'll see it in a different way. And so, you know, wanting to tell the truth and then not always being able to do that, or not even being like, or just being like, well, this is one truth, was a big part of the challenge. But interestingly, I really, towards the end of the book, towards the final draft of the book, was working a lot with calling in Mercury, or Hermes, the god of communication, and kind of grudgingly, because I just identify more with female goddesses, mm-hmm. and also he's like Greek and Roman, which is another, you know, like, obviously we have issues with the Greeks and the Romans, especially as feminists, or anti, you know, colonized, anti-colonialists. But nevertheless, he's the one who came through for me. But interestingly, he's also the deity of liars, and thieves, and right. as well as of communication. And I think it's so interesting how those communication and lying are often so bound up in one another. But what's interesting about him, if you read the works of Jeanette Paris, there's an amazing book called Pagan Meditations, where she talks about the Hermes Mercury archetype. She talks about how when he lies, it's because he's like using his words to advantage him in an unfair playing field. And she talks about how Aphrodite and other like sort of feminized gods and goddesses, since Mercury is definitely the queer god, so he's sort of put in that sort of feminized camp, that they're using the manipulation of the truth, or the way that they tell the truth, in order to gain power in a situation that that is usually marked by brute force, or by like sanction, the authorities, like judicial authorities sanctioning them, or
so interesting. You know. Yes, the beautiful lie.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, I want to ask you more about your guides when you call them. So you've talked about calling in different people, and in the story you talk about like a childhood guide in the form of an animal, the alligator, crocodile.
Weezer.
I love
crocodile.
And you describe like kind of calling him up to you and curling around you, and like you're really making like a suggestion or an offering that like we can kind of call these, we can call these things by whatever names, or give them characters, or see them as animals, but we kind of build an energy around them by doing that, and they're ready to be there for us.
Yeah, those guides, they're so amazing, and the way that we understand them is so... The way that we can understand them is, it's like simple, but also extremely complicated. Like in that, you know, our guides appear, and they come to us, they call to us, and they call to us, we recognize them, we pay attention to them. So they are here all the time. But you might start getting signals, like you might start seeing alligators everywhere, or maybe you start hearing about a deity, like Mercury or Hermes or Venus or Aphrodite or Oshun or who, whatever tradition or lineage you're working through. And, you know, it's like you're not inventing them, they are already there. But then through the power of your attention, you're sort of choosing them, and you're seeing them. And they are essentially facets of the universal, right? They're facets of the universal, or the absolute diamond of spirit, at large. And so they operate in a specific way. And then by aligning yourself with your guides, it's built into the language of what a guide is. Like, a guide is something that leads you. It's something that leads you forward. It's something that gives you direction. And so, you know, I think a lot of the time when we listen to people in New Age or spirituality or even in witchcraft talking about their guides, I'm sure that people standing around the margins of this are kind of eye rolling and being like, what are they talking about? But really, it's the spirit of the thing that leads you forward. And so if you're uncomfortable saying, oh, my guide is, you know, Hermes Trismegistus, or my guide is, you know, Hildegard von Bingen, or my guide is, Mercury, then you can say, you know, you can align yourself with principles like love or justice, mm-hmm. or awareness, or you know, connection or intimacy with the world, and let that thing guide you. But then, you know, it's not so important, like, that you believe that, oh, this is a deity that is guiding me. You can also think of it as, you know, your adult self, or the part of you that wants the best for you, or, mm-hmm. you know, the healed part of you. Like, if that feels more comfortable for you. In the work that I've done with my guides, you know, when we're going really deep, you know, they tell me that it doesn't matter. It, like, you don't have to believe it for it to work. You just have to start to align and harmonize yourself with the energy. So, you know, whether or not you believe Hermes Mercury is coming to you, you know, by calling his name, by doing the invocations, by lighting the incense, by lighting the candles, by doing the dances, by saying the prayers, by singing the songs, you're entering into a relationship with what is essentially this idea of a thing. Mm-hmm. And that idea leads you forward. That idea starts to reflect itself in you. In the way that you work in the world, in the energy that how things transpire around you, or the pattern of events as they occur around you. And so you sort of start to feel the way they move through your life. And to me, that is really interesting and really exhilarating, and also very empowering, because then it means that we get to decide what we want to be guided by. You know, mm-hmm. if we're guided by voices, whose voices? Whose voices are we listening to? You know, we get to make that choice. And so it's important that when we start to, so, you know, for instance, in the book, I had my Weezer, my crocodile guide, and it was really about this primordial power, this sort of protective spirit that was at home and comfortable in the deeps and in the swamps and in the regions where I was being exiled and pushed into. And it was going to guard and protect me there. You know, a lot of the times animal spirits in particular deal with kinds of energy that have not been manipulated by, you know, human intent. There's something primordial about them, something beyond language. They're working in a different way than, like, let's say, guides that are human in form. You know, we're often quite complicated as humans are. But so, you know, we enter into relationships with them, and for pagans, you know, pagan gods, deities, spirits, they're not perfect. Again, as Jeanette Paris talks about, you know, in the pagan pantheons, they're working in in concert, in dialogue with one another. You know, they're an ecosystem of energies, right? So there's not just the one God that is all good, but that they need each other to balance each other out in the same way that it's not, you know, corn is great, but if it's all corn, it's like a monoculture that's ultimately destructive to the ecosystem. But when all the plants and all the animals and all the spirits are there working together and in harmony, then we have flourishing, mm-hmm. then we have vibrancy, and we can do that in our own lives. So when something is out of balance, like let's say, you know, you're not getting enough done, maybe you do need to channel some energy of aggression like Mars or something, or mm-hmm. something more martial or focused. But of course, if that energy gets out of balance, if that spirit gets out of balance, then you're going to want to turn to Aphrodite or Venus or Bridget or, you know, other mm-hmm. goddesses of love. Although Bridget, you know, also has her warrior aspect mm-hmm. as well. So,
yeah, I've had some really powerful experiences with Mars. Not my usual go-to, but when I felt deeply trapped when my daughter was sick and we couldn't get appointments for specialists to help her and I just felt completely paralyzed, she and I did a really fun little baby Martian ritual.
That's so great. What did you do?
I just like, it was, you know, maybe you won't love this based on the conversation we started with, but I'm like a big amateur improviser. So I just walked around my house with her holding her and singing and found red and orange things that we could find and spicy things and gathered them all on the table and leaves. And we made like a spicy cocktail and just sort of sang and danced and then spoke out loud about the help that we needed and sort of stomped around. And she was like 7 months old, so she was just laughing.
That sounds great. I mean, I think that's so beautiful. I think that's exactly right. Like you approach them with like love and reverence and joy and paying attention and using what you have available to you in your environment. And, you know, you build that relationship. And of course, like, yeah, maybe later on as your relationships, you know, if you work with Martian energy more in the future, you'll develop and add to and enhance those rituals, mm-hmm. you know, maybe with some traditions or some traditional things, but that is like such a great way to begin, to open up the relationship. And it's, and also we can just see from that, by doing that, you know, you're empowering yourself, you know, you're moving, you're making choices, you're harmonizing with different colors, with different energies, like the energy of decisiveness, like the energy of choice, you know, the energy of dealing with heat and learning to use that and enjoy that and celebrate it and direct it as you need to. So, I mean, it has all of the important elements of a ritual.
It was exactly that what you described, because the days that followed was very much a balance between me suddenly having new inspiration for things I could try and acting on it right away and not feeling paralyzed, and then the world really reciprocating in some really, I mean, we had 3 cancellations within a week so that we were able to see specialists that we thought would be months away. And, you know, receptionists didn't give the appointment to the person in front of us because he was rude and angry, but gave the appointment to us because, you know, everything just sort of, it was us and it was the world meeting us, you know?
That's brilliant. It sounds like that was some powerful witchcraft that your daughter did.
Yeah, she's a powerful witch. She keeps picking up sticks and shaking them with her whole body.
Pointing them at her wand. Yeah. She's like, calling down the spirits.
Yeah, she's deeply, hilariously witchy all on her own. I don't want to take so much of your time. I know you're so busy, but can I ask, this is my closing question these days, if you have a ritual or a message from your guides or a meditation or a thought that you can leave with me and with our listeners that we can take forward from the Oracle of Los Angeles into our lives and our traumas?
Yeah. So, you know, for people who are just starting out, I always tell them to create an altar, because to create an altar is to create space in your life for spirit. It's like to give your spiritual practice, your witch practice, a home. You know, like it situates it in your life. So build an altar, use your intuition, have something from each of the four elements: water, air, earth, and fire. So for water, you might have shells or a cup of water. For air, you might have feathers or incense or things that are yellow or blue. For fire, you will have candles or sulfur or things that are orange or red. And then for earth, you know, witches often have pentacles, but they could also have stones. You can have fruit. Flowers are also welcome on altars. You'll get an image of the guide that you want to work with, whether it's a deity or some kind of saint, like, you know, like an artist that you admire, or a hero of yours, like a social justice hero. Maybe it's like Harriet Tubman, for instance, or an ancestor that you want to work with, and you'll have it on your altar. And then just start working with it a little bit, which mean, you know, you're not going to demand something from it, but you're going to sort of build a relationship with it. So in the morning, you might sit there and you might present it with offerings like fresh water or wine or, you know, a little smidge of coffee. Water is fine. But you could present it with fruits or gifts or crystals, and then sing it a song or read it a poem. You know, give something of yourself, like offer it something beautiful that you're interested in, and then just sit with your hands on your heart and listen. Just listen, listen deeply, pay attention to what comes up, pay attention to what memories come up, pay attention to thoughts that you have, pay attention throughout the day. And it's good. I have a little notebook on my altar, where I write down, you know, the messages that I get from my meditations, and you can add to them the next day. And even if this is only like a 5 or 10 minute ritual, but you know, that singing piece is really important, because, you know, my spirits, my guides have been telling me that, like, the world, the universe comes into reality through song, and that everything is essentially singing to each other, that song is creation. And just as like when you sing lullabies to your daughter, you know, it's about comforting her. It's about connecting with her. It's about creating peace and beauty with her. And so you can do that too with your spirits and with your guides, even if, like me, you're still cultivating your voice. Mm-hmm. And my voice is not naturally strong. It breaks a lot, and it warbles a lot. But it's really the spirit of, like, humility and gratitude that I'm bringing to the work that I think pleases my spirits. Like, they like to be sung to. And so I suggest that people try that.
Mm. I love that. Thank you so much.
Well, so to close out, we could sing a little song here together.
Should we?
I think we should. Okay. This is a song that I invite your listeners to sing along with us. I'll do I'll sing a phrase, and then you guys can sing it back. And this is also something that if you learn this song, it's a reclaiming chant, but if you learn the song, then you can use it to close out your ceremonies and rituals when you're doing them with your friends. How's that sound?
It's so perfect. Let's give this to all our little baby covens and little baby daughters and little baby witches.
Yeah, all of you out there, just know that we are singing this to you as a blessing of love. And I hope you receive it that way.
And
so,
if your voice breaks when you sing, listeners, that those are the cracks where the light gets in.
Leonard. Yeah. Yes. No. The victory to the goddess, yeah. Victory to Leonard Cohen.
Exactly.
Our poet laureate, our saint of Canada, of Canadian poetry. Yeah. Okay. So, our circle is open.
Our circle is open.
Yet unbroken.
Yet unbroken.
May the peace of the goddess.
May the peace of the goddess.
Be ever in our hearts.
Be ever in our hearts.
Merry meet.
Merry meet.
And merry part.
And merry part.
And merry meet again.
And marry me again.
Yay!
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been such a pleasure. I'm such a fan of yours and your podcast and all of your beautiful listeners. I feel so much joy and gratitude about getting to share all of this with you guys and just to be here. It feels really lovely and wonderful. I'm so grateful to all of you.
It does feel really beautiful, eh? I love this idea of the coven that we create between our ears. I really feel those people there. And I really thank you for blessing us with your presence and your story and your incredible vulnerability. I think it changes the world to share our stories. So thank you.
Yeah, witches are on the rise.
Yeah. You aren't being a proper woman, therefore you must be a witch.
Be a witch. Be a witch. Be a witch. Be a witch. Be a witch.
You must be a witch.
Season 3 of the Missing Witches podcast is lovingly sponsored by Foxglove Farm.